Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 260, and I'm going to tell you that very important skill. I'm going to teach it to you. I'm going to show you how to kill your van the very easiest way possible. We're also going to talk about how to store your van long-term if you need to. We'll have a product review of a tool that has saved my butt a few times. And I'm going to tell you about a place where you can visit Europe in North America. The main topic of today, which I have debated bringing up for a little bit of time now. In fact, that is why this podcast is a day late. I apologize for that. I've had a major van life milestone occur, and not all milestones are good things. This one I would classify as not a good thing. But before I get into this too deeply, I would like to announce that I will not be having a podcast episode next week because I am going through the Bermuda Triangle and I don't expect to survive. No, I'm kidding. I have been through the Bermuda Triangle many, many times. No, I will be on vacation. It is my wife's big vacation of the year, and she desperately deserves it, and I do not want to take time away from her to produce and edit the podcast for that week. So there will be no podcast episode next week. It shall resume the following week. Thank you very much for your patience. I'll just get right to it. I killed my van. My van is dead. It's gone. I mean, it's not gone. I still have it. But I no longer have a van in the sense that I no longer have a van that I can drive and camp in and do all the things one wants to do when one's doing van life. How did this happen? Well, I'm going to tell you, and I don't actually want to tell this story. I am a little bit tired of talking about myself. I would like to talk about van life stuff that isn't directly personal to me, but this is where I am, and it is something that folks can learn from, and after chatting with a few people, I've decided I'm going to just lay it out here, and I hope I don't annoy you with how personal this is. Backing up just a little bit, I have had two vans recently. I have been doing quote-unquote van life in the sense of living and traveling in vehicles for most of my life. I had an NV 200 that I converted out, very successful, loved that build. Van was getting a lot of miles on it. I decided to sell it and then move into a 2011 Mercedes Sprinter 2500 that was an ambulance. And if you've listened to this podcast at all for the last 150 episodes or so, you have heard plenty about this ambulance. And you've heard about all the trials and tribulations I've had with it. And any one of those major problems I've had could have killed the van. And when I say kill the van, I'm not talking about in the sense where you kill a van by driving it into a tree or setting it on fire. I'm speaking in the sense of when this vehicle that is a part of you and a part of your identity departs from that. When I get back from this vacation next week, I'm going to go to the van and remove the hook, waka, bang magnetic signs that are on the van, and then it will no longer be my van. It will no longer be my experience of van life. It will no longer be the thing that I'm constantly working on and constantly planning for, and the place where I feel the most at home, other than being with my wife in the condo. Separating those two things. And the way this has happened is very unpleasant, and there's a lesson to learn here. So it is all related to the fact that I twisted my ankle in 2010 at the City Museum in St. Louis, Missouri. As a result of that ankle twisting, which at the time I didn't think was a big deal, I ended up having a bit of damaged cartilage in my ankle that became ossified or calcified. It basically became hard, and it made it difficult for me to walk in my later years, and I had to have surgery to get that fixed, and I've talked about that. That was back in January, and while I'm well on the road to recovery from that surgery killed my van, and it did it this way. At the end of last year, I put the van to bed, as it were, because I'm in this weird situation where I have to leave my van 100 miles from home, and during the winter months, I wasn't going to be using it anywhere near as much, so I treated the diesel, and I disconnected the batteries, and I basically prepared the thing for winter. And then I had the surgery, and due to the surgery's impact on my life, I wasn't able to get back to the van for months. And then, famously, when I did get back to the van, I forgot the keys, so that took an extra week. And then, when I finally got back to the van, I turned the keys, started right up, and everything was great. All my preparations had worked for about 30 seconds, and then a check engine light came on. Well, that check engine light was throwing some codes. Those codes were related to swirl valves and an actuator. You don't need to know what this stuff is, but if you have a diesel van of that vintage, these things help control the airflow into the intake manifold, and it's part of an emissions regulation thing. And over time, especially in this particular Mercedes engine, they can get gummed up and fail. So I was disappointed by this because I had just spent $1,800 in the fall replacing pulleys and the serpentine belt. This is an annoyance. It's an old van. Stuff like this happens. Fine. Now, I had read that the repair for this can be as simple as spraying some specific cleaner into the turbo, actually, and that costs maybe $20, or $9,000 to replace the intake manifolds, which requires taking the engine apart. Obviously, I am not interested in spending $9,000 on a vehicle this old, so I tried the sprays. Well, the first try didn't work. And I was like, oh, all right. And then I read, well, sometimes you have to do it more times. And I was like, well, you know, when you're doing the risk-reward ratio here, it's worth it to do it. So I bought more of the cans. They're hard to get. They're not sold locally in auto parts shops. You have to order them, and they come from Europe. And when they came, I went back and did it again. And something happened. I got a bit lazy, and instead of spraying directly into the turbo, I sprayed into the hose ahead of the turbo, and I figured, well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is that the MAF sensor is in that hose, and I didn't catch that. I couldn't see where it was. And the spray went into the MAF, and I think I probably killed that sensor, which is dumb, but it's not the end of the world. You can just replace that. In my NV200, I had to replace it. It was not that big of a deal. It's a fairly easy part to replace. You don't need much mechanical ability at all. So, all right, annoying. And I'm looking around and trying to figure out what to do with it. The easy-to-get replacement MAFs have terrible ratings online. Apparently, they don't work. They have the wrong settings for the engine. So I'm like, okay, this is going to be a hassle. Anyway, time. Time is a problem. I don't have a lot of time these days. And so I'm like, all right, I'm going to have to put this away till next week. So next week comes, and then I'm busy, and I start the van to keep the engines charged and stuff, but I don't have time to work for it, so okay, fine. Done. Next week comes, same thing. I really don't have time to deal with it. And then I go to start it, and I notice that I can't even unlock the doors with the fob. I'm like, what the heck's going on here? And I get in with the key, like an old-fashioned person, and the battery's completely dead. The battery is flat. And I'm like, why is the battery flat? I have been keeping this charged. And so I'm like, all right, whatever. I'll figure it out. And, you know, maybe it's because I left an OBD2 port scanner plugged in. Could that have drained the battery somehow? I mean, the lights went out when I turned off the van. I don't know. Whatever. So this van's a little weird. It has two batteries. Because it was an ambulance, it had an extra auxiliary battery under the hood, and this battery wasn't used for starting, it was used for powering the stuff in the ambulance. And while it would not impact the starter battery at all, it would get charged by the alternator, and then if the van was idling and the stuff in the back was drawing too many amps, it would draw on that battery. It's kind of a weird setup, but it's useful if you need to jumpstart the van, because you can jumpstart it from this auxiliary battery. It's just a regular automotive battery. And I've done this many times, and so I just did it, and it didn't work. The van wouldn't start. It still didn't have enough power, and the auxiliary battery was dead too. Like, what? How can that be? I could not figure this out. So I'm looking around to see, like, did a fuse blow or what? And then I brought over my truck, and I'm like, all right, well, the truck with its 5.7 liter Hemi is definitely going to be able to jumpstart this thing. And I hook up the battery, and okay, the van comes back to life. I'm like, okay, we got lights and stuff, and I look at the voltmeter that I had to add because, you know, Mercedes doesn't want you to actually have any gauges or anything. 14.2 volts, which is fine. Like, okay. And so I go to start it, and it doesn't really want to start. It turns over a little bit. I'm like, well, this is really weird. What's going on? So I look around a little bit more into the hood, and I notice that the serpentine belt is just dangling there. It's not attached to anything. And now's the mystery. How did the serpentine belt fall off of a truck that's just sitting there? I don't know. No, I am at a loss to explain what happened. Could it be that way back in the fall, when I had all this work done, the guy didn't put the serpentine belt on right and it fell off? Maybe. And then I've been driving around all this time using the battery, but it wasn't charging, that the alternator wasn't producing any power? Maybe, but that should have generated a light on the dashboard. It also should have generated codes, which were not there. No, that is not what happened. The guy may have screwed up, I'm not saying that, but that is not what happened. Somehow, that belt fell off where I have the van parked on my property while I wasn't driving. I have no explanation for this. The only thing I can figure is that while I was adding the spray cleaner, which causes the RPMs to go up and down, if you ever use this kind of spray cleaner in this engine, basically, you spray it in short spurts, and the engine shoots up to 3,000 RPM and then goes back down. It's a cycle over. The only thing I can guess is that doing that caused this belt to jump off somehow. But I didn't notice it at the time. The alternator light never came on, and that is connected to this belt. I'm at a complete loss. The only other wrinkle to this is that when I opened the hood, there was a buckeye sitting on the radiator that had clearly been chewed by some kind of squirrel or something. So I don't know, is something living under there and chewing? I don't know. But here's the part that is the real problem. I can't fix this. I called the place down there that worked on the van and put the belt on, and they said they can't fix it. They're not even willing to like do warranty work or anything, because they're like, well, it's been sitting around so long, you know, that really could be anything, so we don't think it's us. And we don't have a diesel tech anymore, which was the real thing. It's like, okay. There's no one who will work on this van anywhere near me, which means it needs to be towed somewhere, probably about 100 miles away. And okay, I've done that before. I can do that. I can have it towed to the Chicago Sprinter mechanic, who charges incredible amounts of money. And then I'm thinking, well, no, this is, I know where this path leads. This path leads to me having a non-operational van at the dealership in Chicago and an estimate of $9,000, which I will not pay. Bottom line here is, I'm done. I am done. And that's what killed my van. I still have the van. It's still built out. I could absolutely go in the back of the van and do van life just as I always have, because everything in the back works perfectly. I just can't drive it. I could roll it up onto a trailer and turn it into a trailer camp. You know, you see what's going on here. So what killed my van? The thing that killed my van is that I let it sit. Don't let your vans sit, especially if they happen to be an NV3 Sprinter, which is the model, the generation of Sprinter that this is. Some people call it the second generation Sprinter. That gets complicated, but it's the NV3 from like maybe 2008 to 2016, I think, of the years. Don't let those vehicles sit. First off, they have a parasitic battery drawer right from the factory. The battery will die in about 3 to 4 weeks, even if you don't do anything. So that's a problem you have to overcome, fairly easy one. Second, as they get older, there is some kind of an oil that drips in very, very, very minute amounts near the turbo housing that gets onto the swirl flap actuator, and that gums things up over time. But if you keep driving it, it stays lubricated enough that the swirl valves still work. My best guess here is because the van sat for so long, that stuff dried and gunked up and killed the actuator motor. I mean, I'm getting very detailed here because I've spent so much time on this. But the bottom line is here, at some point during your van life, you will part from your van, and it's an emotional experience. I have spent countless hours and sadly countable dollars trying to make this the best van I could for my van life. And I have had many amazing experiences in this van. I've been all over the country. I've learned a lot of things. I have made it a very comfortable place for me to be, which kind of is the goal for me. And now I am done. And it's because I chose the wrong van, which is my fault, and also the fault of COVID and the lack of availability of vans. And I let it sit, even though there was nothing I could have done about it because I literally couldn't walk, never mind drive, to get down there to start the van. So now what? I'm doing a van life podcast and I don't have a van. At least I don't have one that runs. Well, that's it, right? That's the end. I can end the podcast here and say thank you all very much and be done with van life because I don't have a van anymore and that's the end of it. But no, that's not going to stand. No, that is not going to stand at all. I need some time to process this because, again, this is not just a hunk of metal. This is an emotional thing. And while my problems are clearly set in the first world, and there are folks out there who are going through much, much worse for much less fault of their own, I have that perspective. It's still true that this is impacting me in major ways, emotionally and financially. Now, the financial part is one thing. The emotional part is the more difficult thing, and it's why this podcast is a day late and why I debated even talking about it. So at this point, this is what I've come to as a conclusion. The van must be removed from my life in its entirety, and how to do that is a bit tricky. I could try to sell it as is with full disclosure about what's going on there. I mean, after all, it is built out. 200 amp hours of lithium batteries in there. It has an MPPT solar controller, 300 watts on the roof. It has a microwave. It has 3,000 watt inverter. You know, it has a bed that folds out. It has all that stuff. It has all the stuff you need. And if somebody happened to be a diesel mechanic filled with knowledge of how these vans work and can do the work themselves, they could probably have a pretty nice van for maybe $1,000 in parts if they're doing their own labor. I mean, literally, I don't know, and that's part of the problem. But I'm not willing to deal with that. That's why this is someone else's problem now. I just have to figure out how to get it to something else. So I have two basic thoughts. The first is a long shot, but I'm going to throw it out there. If you are listening to this podcast and you have the ability to work on Mercedes Sprinter 2500 NV3 vans and could possibly be interested in this, I would be willing to sell you the entire thing for maybe $5,000. That would be, I think, a fair value for this van, because even without its engine, the parts are worth more than that. And the engine is full of new parts. I think the engine can be saved. The problem is it's the labor. If the actuator and swirl motor need to be replaced, that's a lot of labor. And I do not know what's going on with the serpentine belt. That is a mystery. But I think in reality what's going to happen is I'm going to donate it to one of these places that takes cars as a donation for a tax write-off, because I think that's going to be the best path towards retrieving as much financial gain as possible out of this thing that I've poured endless amounts of money into. And then I have the decision of whether I should strip it. Like, do I let it go as is, or do I take that battery out that's worth a couple $100, and do I take the solar panels off and the controller and all this stuff that I can use in another vehicle? I have to make that decision, and I'm not going to do anything elaborate. I'm not going to part the van out or sell all these components or anything like that. I don't have time, but I am going to do something, and I do not have a van right now. I have a truck. I obviously have an Airstream, which I don't intend to move around with. I mean, the Airstream is great and everything, but I'm using it more as a tiny house than a van. I have a Tiki Bago that also doesn't run, and I don't intend to ever make it run because I don't think it's safe. It's also a tiny house. I'm going to have to change the podcast to a tiny house podcast. No, I'm not. No. Seriously, though, I do have a plan. The podcast is going to continue as always. It is still going to be the same, but the van life part is going to have to embrace the big tent concept of van life that I have promoting since day one. I am going to get a truck camper. I have talked about this before, but now I'm shifting gears a little bit. I'm actually going to get more of a truck camper. I had originally thought that I would have the van and the truck, and I was going to use the truck as like a no-build camper shell camper for maybe quick trips or things where I needed to tow heavy things or something like that. Now that's going to be my main vehicle, and I'm not going to do the no-build because I'm actually going to get a slide-in truck camper. So you're probably going to be hearing a lot about truck campers going forward, but I will keep in mind that most people, when they hear van life, they, of course, think of vans. Mentally, I am more of a van person than a truck and truck camper person. I love having a van that I can just walk in back and have everything I need right there with me all the time as my daily driver. I love that. I just can't have that right now for two reasons. One is that the truck, I need the truck to be able to move the Airstream. The Airstream is very heavy, and that is the minimum truck that can tow the Airstream. So I need the truck. I can't get rid of the truck. And then the idea of getting another van that, you know, would be built out and everything, I'm not willing to do that because I have the same problem. It's going to sit. And sitting kills vans. So, yeah, I'm going to go this way. As to what I'm going to get for a truck camper, I don't know. I have a budget. I'm looking at several different options. And unfortunately for me, I'm going to have to remove the truck camper when I'm not using it because my parking space in Chicago, it's not wide enough for me to park with a truck camper unless I got a truck camper that was the same width as the truck. Those do exist, but they're fairly hard to get. So that's where I'm at. And it's been difficult. And I appreciate the support from you guys. But learn from this. So what are the lessons we've learned from this experience over the last few years? Don't buy a Sprinter. Don't buy an ambulance. Don't buy a Sprinter ambulance. Never buy a diesel Sprinter ambulance. And absolutely do not, under any circumstances, buy an NV3 diesel Sprinter ambulance. And if you do, don't let it sit. I hope that at least helps somebody out there. And at the end of the day, what does this all mean? Everything is content. A special thank you this week to everybody who donates every month at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Thank you, guys. I don't name you by name every week because, you know, that would get tedious. But I really do appreciate it. And this week, I'm calling out just you. There are no ads on this podcast because of folks like that. If you would like to become one of them, please visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1, where you can make a one-time donation of as little as $5. Or you can become a monthly supporter. Whatever works for you. Van Life News. So this week I have 3 news items, and they're all basically on the same topic, and they all seem to boil down to this. Electric vans are stalling, like not literally, but the onslaught of electric vans that we saw coming a few years ago seems to have stopped, and I've got 3 news articles that support that idea. I am not in favor of this idea. Please do not present this as evidence that electric vans are stupid. No, that is not where I'm coming from. I'm simply reporting the news, and I'm a little bit disappointed because I see electric vans as progress, and I see what's happening as not progress. So the first one is from Freep, which is the Detroit Free Press, and they say, GM to halt Bright Drop production with little work planned until fall of 2025. Bright Drop was the replacement van from General Motors. It was going to replace the Chevy Express, which was the last big American van. And that was supposed to end production this year or next year. And they were going to replace it with this big, fancy new electric van. And the Bright Drop van looks pretty cool. I like it. It has a lot of features for it, and it's publicly available. And the range, you know, you've got all the same problems. But the range was getting better. I was encouraged that maybe this would be the one. If all these people who own Express vans bought a fleet of these, if there was more support for them and it was easier to charge them and etc., like maybe this will be the way. Yeah, no. No, it's not the way. There are rumors of massive parking lots filled with fleets of these vehicles because nobody wants them. And the problem is that companies can't afford to take risks, I think. This is my thought. If you have a fleet of vans, they are crucial to your business. Those vans have to be ready to go every day. If something goes wrong, they need to be able to be fixed immediately and replaced quickly if something bad happens. And these Bright Drop vans, because they're new, because there's new policies they need to produce, because they need to figure out how to repair them, because it's not like you can just go to the Bright Drop mechanic. You know, it's not like every Chevy dealer is going to support these. I think people are afraid. Also, there's, you know, a stigma against electric vehicles, which weirdly right now in the U.S. comes from both the right and the left politically. So, yeah, I think people just are afraid of them. I've heard similar stories about the e-transits as well, that every Ford dealer in the U.S. was required to have a certain number, and they've had a really hard time selling them. So, again, I'm just reporting the news here. I'll have links in the show notes, of course. And there's another possible issue here is that these were produced in Canada, and where we in the U.S. now are living with these tariffs on, tariffs off policy that is confusing everything. That could be related, but bottom line is GM has stopped production of these things, at least until the fall of 2025. Related, Rivian, who makes the Amazon vans, if you have seen any electric van in your life, it is probably an Amazon van, at least in the US. But the problem is that Amazon is now frustrated because they can't get parts for them. And Amazon owns 15% of Rivian, so, you know, this is a little incestuous. But they're having a problem with parts. Now, electric vans, you don't need as many parts, you know. Obviously, they don't have oil changes, they don't have engine parts that wear out, but, you know, they have things like brakes and body parts and stuff like that that need to be replaced. Those are hard to get now. Rivian has just stopped making the electric vans that Amazon's using. And what does this mean to Amazon? Well, as we saw during the pandemic, and we've seen a few times with Amazon losing contracts with UPS and stuff like that, that they're just going to buy every van in existence and paint them and get them on the road. They don't actually care. I mean, they care, but they're going to get the packages out there. They will do whatever they have to, you know, including renting entire fleets of U-Hauls and taking up all the local U-Hauls, which I've seen happen around Christmas time, is lots of U-Hauls with like little paper stickers on the side that say Amazon. So, another case where the promise of these electric vans is not holding true just quite yet. And then the last thing, which is actually very interesting, GM van sales. Now, backing up here, when this says GM van sales, they mean the Chevy Express, etc. They jumped 44% in quarter four of 2024. They're selling more of the gasoline-powered ones than they did before. Now, that can be explained a few different ways. One is that these vans are getting near end of life, and if you're somebody with a large fleet of these and you have a production based on these vans, you have all the parts for them, you have mechanics who know how to work on them, you're going to want to get as many as you can before you are forced to switch to something else. Southwest Airlines works like this. They only fly 737s because of this. Or it could be simply that's the van people want. You know, it's possible that, at least from a work standpoint, people want these vans. It's a known quantity. They can predict them. They know how to amortize the expenses. They know how it's going to impact their business. What does this all mean for van life? All three of these stories have an impact on van life. I don't know exactly what it is. I can't predict the future, but there could be increased pressure on new vans in the U.S. as a planned switch to electric doesn't take place. There could also be a lot of these electric vans coming on the market. If companies tried them and don't like them and divest from them, we might see a whole bunch of electric vans available that for that innovative van lifers could turn into van life fans. But I don't know. We'll see. Should any of that happen, I will report it here. Links in the show notes, of course. And I mentioned the Detroit Press for the first link. The second one comes from Investopedia, and the third is from GM Authority. So all pretty good sources. Have a look if you're interested. Tech Talk! So, I have told you how I killed my van. I'm now going to tell you how not to kill your van if you're in a similar situation. Van life people are travelers. Travelers travel. Sometimes they can't bring their van, you know? You might have a chance to spend 4 weeks in Bermuda somewhere, and bringing your van to Bermuda is not advisable. It would be incredibly expensive. I did not see a single camper van in Bermuda when I was there recently. How do you prevent what happened to me from happening to you? Kelley Blue Book, a company that knows a bit about maintaining values of cars, had some advice. And they learned a lot from COVID-19 because obviously during COVID, people weren't driving anywhere near as much and a lot of cars sat. And so they got to see what happened. First thing, where do you store? Well, the very best place is in a climate-controlled garage, which is not available to most people. Second best place is a garage. If you have that, third best place is a carport or covered car storage. Obviously, you just want to keep the thing out of the sun. And then the last option there is a car cover, some kind of cover you put over your car. But that requires some research that I can't get into in this short bit here. But don't just buy a car cover and put it over your dirty car. That's bad. Do your research before you do a car cover. Spend more money than you want to. The cheap car covers can actually damage your car. And then after that, well, leave it away from any trees that might fall on it, which was what I was doing. That said, how do you prepare the car? Number one, clean your car. Well, yeah, you do want to clean your car because the stuff on the outside of your car can actually do damage. Things like bird droppings and pine tar and even pollen, all that stuff can actually damage your finish and gum things up if it's left to sit too long. Now, normally, even if you don't wash your van very often, I mean, I hardly ever wash my van, but the rain will wash a lot of that stuff off every time I drive in the rain. When the thing's just sitting there, well, basically, you're not driving in the rain. So make sure you do wash it before you put it away. I did not, but anyway. Number two, fill the fuel tank. Why? Well, you might think, well, I don't want to do that because that fuel's going to age. I don't want all that old fuel in there. Well, you're worried about something else. If you have an older van especially, if you don't fill the tank, there's air in your tank. And that air has moisture in it. And that moisture can cause problems. It can rust the tank from the inside. The water, it gives space for water to actually build up in the tank. And you don't want that in a diesel or a gasoline tank. Fill the tank and then, actually, in the middle of filling it, add a fuel stabilizer, either gasoline or diesel. You can buy these anywhere, and that will help. It will help take the moisture out, and there's other stuff in there. Like if it's a diesel, it has algicide in it that prevents things from growing in your diesel, because living things like to live in diesel fuel. And for gasoline, it helps stabilize it and increases the octane a bit. These things do not last forever. They last for maybe a year at most, so keep that in mind. Number three is the battery. Most vehicles have some sort of parasitic draw on the battery in varying amounts. You ever notice that when you get in your car, all your favorite radio stations are still programmed in there? Yeah, that takes battery power to do that. That's just one little example. There's lots of things using the battery. So obviously you're going to turn the thing off and take the key out, but yeah, you should probably disconnect the battery too. And when you do this, you lose all your settings and stuff, which is a pain in the butt. One note, and I learned this the hard way, when you reconnect the battery, when you put that negative terminal back on, make sure you do it smoothly. Do it all at once. Make sure it makes a really good contact immediately. There was one time I was reconnecting the battery in my Sprinter, and I missed, basically. To be clear here, the negative terminal on the Sprinter is by the gas pedal. It's not like most vehicles. You have to reach up under there and push this thing on. And I pushed it on, but then slipped and fell off. What happened is the vehicle saw the battery signal and started all these procedures and policies and started moving things. And then it instantly got disconnected and the vehicle was left in the middle of that. And that's bad. And I will add to this that do not drive your vehicle somewhere and then just disconnect the battery. Stuff goes on after you shut off your engine. It's doing all kinds of weird things, and sometimes you can even hear it. You'll turn the vehicle off, take the key out, and you'll hear all these motors and stuff moving. They're doing some emissions control stuff. They're moving fluids around, and that process takes about 10 minutes to be safe, half an hour. Let it sit and then disconnect it. But when you do reconnect it, do it carefully all in one motion and leave it connected for at least 10 minutes so that it can do its thing. Number four, change the oil. Yeah, it's a good idea to have fresh oil in there if you're going to let it sit, because oil over time can change its pH, and the pH can get acidic, and that acid can eat away at things over time. So if you put in fresh oil, you don't have to worry about that. Keep bugs out. Yeah, you got to do some kind of pest control. Honestly, in my van, I put mouse traps in there, and they work. You know how I know that. Mice do a lot of damage. And I don't like killing the things, but it's the best I can do. I've considered all the options, and that's the one that makes the most sense, and it's the most humane, honestly. And I recycle the mice. The mice do get eaten by the local wildlife, so I'm just kind of skipping a step there. But anyway, mice will destroy your vehicle. They absolutely will. That actually could be what's wrong with my van. They may have gotten up into the engine and chewed a bunch of wires, and the computer just doesn't know what the heck's going on. It may have caused the engine to run backwards, actually, which is a thing, and that could have thrown the belt off. I don't know. This is an interesting one. Overfill the tires. Now, you got to remember that you did this. Over time, a sitting vehicle will lose air pressure in its tires. I see this all the time. In the Winnebago and in the Airstream, as they sit there, I can see the tires lose air over time. If you overfill your tires, you're mitigating that somewhat, but you're also protecting the tires, because if tires sit for too long, they can develop a flat spot. And this was a big problem with the little trailer I had, that every spring it would have this flat spot, and I'd have to drive around for like 20 miles before it would stop going zoomf, 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 zoomf. when you overinflate them, you're helping to prevent that flat spot. You just have to remember to check the air pressure again when you reinvigorate the vehicle in the spring. Big tip here, do not use the parking brake, because if you leave the parking brake on for a long time, it can actually seize. Parking brakes are very simple things, also known as emergency brakes, same thing. They have just a wire going to a cable going to the brakes, no hydraulics, unless you've got a transmission parking brake. I mean, there's many different ways, but basically, just leave it off. That's all you have to know. If you leave it on, it can get stuck, and that's bad. Number eight, lubricate. Yeah, go ahead and lubricate all the stuff you would normally lubricate. Fill the locks with antifreeze, lubricant, stuff like that. Lubricate the hinges, all that kind of stuff, because as the thing sits, the lubrication will be less effective, and you may find squeaky doors when you open it up in the spring. And that's it. Sounds simple, right? Yeah, I did most of that. It didn't help me. But you want the best chance you possibly can. Vehicles don't like to sit. That's the bottom line. So you have to do the best you can with what you've got. Product review. In the course of recent events, I have found myself needing to jumpstart many different vehicles, not just the van. I had to jumpstart my truck because I left the hazard lights on stupidly, which I'm really surprised that the hazard lights killed the battery, but oh well. And what I've been using is this thing I talked about a while ago. It is the Avapow Jump Starter, A-V-A-P-O-W. I've never heard of that brand, of course. There's 8 million different ones of these. But if you haven't encountered these yet, I am a big fan, and I think everybody should have one because it'll save your butt, especially if you're out in the woods. This is a little box, maybe the size of a pound cake, and it has jumper leads on it, just like jumper cables. And it's basically a lithium battery in a box. You charge it up over USB, and then you put it in your van, and it can sit there for months and months and months and months and months. But when you need it, you hook it up to the battery, and you can start your vehicle. And it starts my truck, my V8 big 5.7 liter Hemi. Yeah, it'll start that. So it's not like it's only for wimpy little engines. And you can start it maybe 3 or 4 times before it needs to be recharged. Now, this is not just simply a battery with cables connected to it. It's got circuitry in it. And that's good and bad. The good of that is that it will not work unless it's safe to do so. It connects to the battery, and it has to detect some voltage coming from the battery in order to charge it. If your battery has no voltage, the leads on the jump starter are off. You can't, like, touch them together and make sparks or anything like that. So that's actually good. It's nice and safe. What's bad about that is that you can't use this thing for an emergency power supply as like the leisure battery in your vehicle, which is something I've tried to do. Like if you disconnect the battery from the back of your van and then hook this up instead, it won't do anything. So that's not a use case for this. But for jumpstarting your vehicle, absolutely. It also lets you use the battery as a USB bank, and a big one. So it's small enough to fit in a backpack. So if you were going camping for a couple days, yeah, you could toss this thing in there to keep your phone charged. It would absolutely do that. There's probably smaller things that can do that, but this does that too. Yes, and it has a light in it, which everything seems to have a light in it these days. And while it seems silly, I have used the light, so it's not that silly, especially if you were in a situation where it's late at night and you open your hood and it's dark and you need to hook things up. Having that light there, even though you've got one on your phone too, is a little bit of reassurance. So this is a long-term review of this thing. It has been absolutely perfect. The only complaint I have about it is that it comes in this nice case and the zipper broke on the case. That's my only complaint. I actually have to hold it together with a rubber band, but it works and is now on sale for $70 on Amazon. I have a link in the show notes. I'm sure many of the other similar products perform as well, but this is the one that I have used and I am positive that it works. I think this is a really good thing to have in every vehicle, not even vans, just for safety. Set an alarm on your phone for every 6 months that you'll bring it in the house and plug it into USB-C and charge it and then put it back. And you will never get stuck because of a dead battery ever again. I think that's a really nice insurance policy. Tales from the road. Oh, way back long ago, I inherited my mother's 1977 Ford LTD2, which, given that it was 1977, I took to calling LTD2. And you maybe get that reference, and maybe you don't. And me and LTD2, well, this was my very first car that was kind of mine. And this was a boat of a car. This was a ridiculous car. It was getting near the end of the 70s, and they were still making these gigantic cars with these huge hoods. And it was a two-door. And the doors were like the size of boats, you know. You had to basically park all by yourself in the parking lot so you could open the door fully and get out. But it was my car. It was my first set of wheels. And back then, that was a very, very big deal. Nowadays, it doesn't seem like kids have that same experience, but back then, getting your driver's license and your keys and having a car you could use whenever you want was huge. My dad once said, you know, it's going to take you 5 years to learn how to drive properly. Doesn't matter about following the rules and passing the tests. It takes 5 years to develop the skills necessary to be a good driver. And I think he was right. And in those 5 years where I was learning this, I did some stupid things. One of them was, for some reason, I saw an empty field up in Topsfield, Massachusetts. I happen to remember where it was. And I decided to drive in it. I was like, oh, look at that. Big, wide open field. I thought, I'm just going to go drive in the field and see what it's like to just drive a vehicle off-road. And, I mean, it wasn't really off-road. It was a nice, big, flat-level field. So, yay, you know, and I, you know, cranked up some tunes on my auto stop cassette player. And I head out there. And I'm like, okay, I'm living the life now. I'm a man with a car and driving straight. And then I tried to turn and it didn't turn. And then it slowed down and then it stopped. And then I was like, oh, that's mud. And so I'm out there stuck in the mud in this car. And I, at the time, was working security at a Boy Scout jamboree that was going on at the Topsfield Fair. And I was in my Boy Scout uniform. And I'm standing out in the field, or as I would prefer to say, I was outstanding in the field. And I'm just like looking around wondering what to do. I hadn't have clue one. No cell phones back then. And this guy, he happens to drive by, and he's got this kind of souped up a little bit. Do they use that term anymore? Souped up? That means you take a car and you make it fancy and put in big engines and headers and anyway, I'm old. You'll have to deal with it. And he sees me and he says, hey, you need help? And I was like, yeah, I don't really know what to do. And he said, all right. And to my surprise, this guy in his nice car drove out in the field. And I'm like, well, no. Stop. You're coming out. I thought he was going to get stuck too. And he was a little bit older than me and was a more experienced driver, apparently, and he was able to drive out there, and he came up right behind my car, and he says, hey, well, let's try to push it. Now, in the perspective that I have now of having some years of knowledge of driving, this is a dumb idea. First off, pushing somebody out of the mud almost inevitably means both cars will get stuck in the mud. Second, you can't push a car with another car without damaging one or both of the cars. But back then, I was like desperate, and I was like, what do I do? So he said, okay. And so I stand back, and I said, sure, if you're willing to do it, you know. And he drives up to the back of the car and sticks his chrome bumper up against my chrome bumper and steps on the gas. And instantly, his car jumps the chrome bumper of my car and crushes the taillights. I was like, whoa. And he's like, oh, and he backs up, and fortunately didn't get stuck. He backs up, and he's like, oh, man, I'm sorry. I didn't know that was happening. Now, I had the perspective that I had gotten myself into this situation. I had given this man permission to try this thing, and that anything that happens is my fault, not his. So I absolutely wasn't blaming him or upset with him in any way, shape, or form. I was like, oh, no, that's all right, man. I appreciate you trying to help, and apparently this isn't going to work. And as we're discussing this, a police car drives by, and this guy sees the police car, and he says, all right, man, sorry, I couldn't help, I gotta go. And he hops in his car, and again, must be a better driver than me, gets through the mud and hits the road and goes away at fairly high speed. Now, the cop had decided that the cop needed to deal with me, because I'm in basically on private property in the stuck vehicle. He did not drive out in the mud because he's smarter than me, and walks up and says, hey, what's going on here? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I drove out here and it was stupid and I got stuck in the mud. He said, what about that other guy? And I was like, oh, he was just trying to help. I was like, you want me to go after him? And this guy was so ready to hop in his police car and chase after this guy. And I was like, no, he didn't do anything wrong. He was just trying to help me. So he goes, why is he running? And like, I don't know the guy. He was just, you know, anyway. So I finally convinced the cop not to go after the Good Samaritan. I was like, so he was trying to push me out. I notice you, on your police car, you have the overriders. There are things on the front of a police car that you can use to push a vehicle. I was like, can you give me a push? He said, no, we're not allowed to do that. I was like, okay, well, he said, we're going to have to get a tow truck. And I'm like, okay, is there a phone near here or can you call a tow truck? And it's like, well, if I call you a tow truck, then we're going to have the vehicle impounded. And I'm like, oh God. And I've got to be back at work. And I'm like, I said, well, have you tried rocking it? I was like, well, I mean, it's a heavy car. I can only push it so much. He's like, no, you rock it. You get in the driver's seat and you put it in drive, go forward a little bit, put it in reverse, go in. You just go keep doing that back and forth and back and forth, and sometimes that'll get you unstuck. And the cop is seeing him a little annoyed. It also amused at this point. I was like, nope, I haven't tried that yet. I'll try it now. This is a good skill to have, it turns out. If you are stuck in a vehicle, especially a rear-wheel drive vehicle, you can do this thing with an automatic transmission, preferably, where you put it in drive, and even if you're stuck, it'll probably go forward a foot. And then immediately put it in reverse and go a foot backwards, but it'll actually be 2 feet. And then if you can keep up this momentum, you will create a momentum pendulum where the vehicle will move farther than it did before. And if it moves far enough, you'll get out of the mud. And believe it or not, I was able to get out this way. And one time when I reversed, the car jumped out of the rut and kept going. And I started to slow down to thank the cop, and he said, don't stop, just keep going back until you hit the pavement. And he was right, that's exactly the right thing to do. And I got to the pavement and stopped and talked with the cop, and he was like, didn't want to do any paperwork. So that was the end of my interaction with him, and I actually got back to work on time. And I learned a whole bunch of lessons from that. I learned that there are good people in the world. I learned that cops, like cats, like to chase moving things. And I learned that cops are not infinitely helpful. They have limits. And I also learned they hate to do paperwork. Oh, yeah, and I also learned the rocking trick. Quick note on the rocking trick. That can get you stuck, but it also is very hard on your transmission. So don't go crazy with that. But getting stuck in the mud and out of the mud is a whole other topic. I just wanted to tell that nice, simple little story. A place to visit. This podcast is running so long that I can't get into the depth that this deserves. But if you've ever wanted to visit France in your van, and you're in North America, but you didn't want to pay the expense of shipping your van to Europe, which is expensive, several thousand dollars, probably $10,000 all told to go back and forth with your van from North America to Europe, you can still visit France. Because at the bottom of Newfoundland in Canada, there's a place called Saint-Pierre in Miquelon, anglicized pronunciation, that is France. It's not technically France. It's not sort of France. It is France. France, the country of France, owns land all over the world. You know, it's not just in Europe. If you go to the South Pacific, there's a lot of France in South Pacific. This is France. It's real France. And it's an island. You have to take a ferry or fly there. But once you get there, you are in France. And there is a ferry that can hold 18 vehicles, I looked it up, and your van can be one of them. You can drive your van. I have Canadian friends who simply disregard this place as being part of Canada, because it's not part of Canada. It is another country, and yes, the land is very, very close to Canada, but it's not Canada, it's France. Even the French-speaking people in Quebec don't go there, because it's France. I mean, some do. It's a crazy, crazy story. It's actually mostly associated with Basque culture rather than French culture. It's on my bucket list. I've wanted to go there for many, many years. But if you are looking for a new place to go because maybe your national parks plans have been canceled, it's a long drive. But you can legitimately say you drove to France if you go to this place. I'll have a link in the show notes to the Wikipedia article. There is a lot of depth here. This place has a fascinating history, and I really wish I could devote a whole podcast episode to it, but then this would be a different podcast. So take a moment and go look. Saint-Pierre and Miquelon, not in Canada, but yeah, in Canada-ish. Don't kill me. Resource recommendation. A lot of you have sent the latest video of Camping with Steve, where he creates the ultimate stealth vehicle. And, well, I'll just spoil it because this video has already gotten 5 million views on YouTube. He creates a pile of pallets on a trailer. All right, that's not that impressive. What is impressive is that it's a camper. This pile of pallets inside is a camper, and it's like this amazing stealth vehicle, totally going viral, and Camping with Steve is always worth watching anyway. However, I want to point you out to a time when he outdid this. 9 months ago, he created a different stealth vehicle that was stealthier than this. You see, pallets have some value. People want pallets. And if they see a trailer full of pallets, some people think, I'll just help that guy out and remove some of his pallets so he doesn't have to dispose of them. So you could get that sort of nuisance attraction from this latest build of Steve. But his older one, his other one, probably not. Because he created a stealth camper out of branches. Same idea, but he basically made it look like somebody had just trimmed trees on their property and they were going to the dump. And it's in the back of a truck, not a trailer. So it's an old beat-up truck with a bunch of branches in the back. It is completely ignorable and uninteresting, and yet he camped in it and had a wonderful meal. And it's actually a better video than the one that went viral here. So I have a link to that in the show notes. If you enjoyed the pallet video, definitely watch this one. And if you've never heard of Camping with Steve before, please watch Camping with Steve. There's something about these videos that's just heartwarming. He's just this nice guy who goes out there and makes videos of camping in really, really strange places. And they're not super technical. They're not super high production value or anything like that. It's just spending a moment with this gentle soul. And I really enjoy it. And I actually own a Camping with Steve hoodie that my wife was nice enough to get for me that says, "Hunker down!" Because that's what you do when you're hiding out in the woods. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to this, again, overly long and overly personal episode. I really appreciate it. You can get a hold of me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Until next time, remember the words of Chris Pine, who said, "The only thing you sometimes have control over is perspective. Don't have control over your situation, but you have a choice about how you view it."